Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. This is Dale Stevens, and we're here with Michael Ellsberg, the author of The Education of Millionaires. I think we're going to have a lively conversation today. Michael has written a fabulous book about the skills that you won't learn in school but are requisite for success in the real world. It's a must-read this fall.
Dale, it's so good to be here. I was joking when I was setting some stuff out about this. I don't know which one of you or me is more passionate about this issue. So we're gonna have to duke it out in our passion on this issue. And I find every time I say something like controversial and provocative about it, like you say something more controversial, that I say something more, and we just try to like outdo each other on this. So this is gonna be a fun
it's
hour.
It's just like being back in college.
That's right. That's right. Except, you know, we're not binge drinking this time. So at least not while we're on the call. Maybe later.
I don't know that. You're in New York, so I can never
That's right,
be
yeah.
sure. So throughout interviewing these millionaires and billionaires, what common threads did you find about their secrets to success?
Well, one thing that I thought was really relevant, it was common to all of them and was really relevant to this call, was they seem to be totally unconcerned with traditional check marks and punch cards for success. So most of us, and including me for my earlier years of my life, are very concerned about things like grades, you know, getting little gold stars in school and the right letters on your report card, and then later SAT scores and AP classes, and then GPA, and, you know, making your resume look good. And that is one model for success, and certainly you can be successful focusing on all those things. But the people I interviewed just did not care about those things. They really didn't. Anything that was kind of smelled of someone else giving them a permission to be successful, like you can be successful if you get this score, you can be successful if you get these grades, if you have these letters after your name, they just ignored that and just went out directly and learned directly what they had to learn to be successful instead of waiting for someone's permission. So that's one thing that almost all of them had in common.
And how have you learned in your own life to not care about check marks?
That's a great question. So a bit about my background. I'm 34, and I've just written, as you mentioned, this book about success. People who dropped out of college like you or who didn't even go to college and who went on to become very successful professionally, either millionaires or billionaires. And I'm not an example of the people I write about. I'm not a millionaire yet, and I did go through educational track. And in fact, I went through a very formal and elite education. I did, you know, very well in high school. I went to Deerfield Academy, which is a exclusive prep school in Massachusetts. I would do 5-6 hours of homework a night, you know, even at age 16. Well, and I'm sure we'll get into this issue of homework later in the call, because I think it's really doing damage to the youth of today. Anyways, I went through that track. I went to Brown University. I did great there. I got straight A's, Phi Beta Kappa, Honor Society, all that stuff. So for the first 22 years of my life, I was totally on this track of credentials, you know, getting check marks, doing what your parents and society says. And then I had a shock. I got out of college, and I had employment, and I didn't know how the fuck to make my way in the world at all. I was miserable in my job. I didn't really know how to interface with a job, because a workplace, you know, is all the office politics are totally different than what you would encounter in an academic situation. I hadn't really paid any attention to how I wanted to earn my living, what I wanted my career to be, all those things. You know, I was just in this kind of academic bubble. And I got a real bad wake-up call. And my 20s really were kind of a mess, to be honest. You know, I'm 34 now. I've thankfully gotten out of that mess and am loving my profession and am, you know, am happily married and have a life that I love now, but my 20s were not like that. My 20s, I was very confused professionally. I bumped around from gig to gig. I didn't really know how to earn money. I moved back in my parents' basement at one point, which apparently now about 45% of 20-somethings move back with their parents at least once. I was one of those 45% for a couple years, which I love my parents, but those were not a happy 2 years of my life. So the 20s were a mess, and I wrote this book. I said, you know what? I'm not the only one who's like this. This seems to be a national pandemic of people messed up in their 20s, not knowing how to make their way. And I was certainly one of them. I'm definitely not trying to do a holier-than-thou number here. But once I got out of that, I started thinking, well, why is this happening? And I think a big part of it, like the main part of it, is our schooling system from a young age right through college. So I wanted to write a book that counteracted some of that. And ideally, I could give it to someone your age or someone who is, you know, just out of college, and they could avoid some of the confusion and mistakes that I made in my 20s.
So if the book is focused on looking at success in non-traditional ways, then why is the metric of success for the people that you interviewed in the book based around how much money they earned?
That's a great question. And I know, Dale, you and I kind of debate a lot around this, about how to define success and what to write about. A couple answers to that. One is that I wanted to start a national dialogue around this. And most people, you've got to bait the hook. You know, if you got to give bait the hook with the right kind of bait. So I do talk a lot about things around meaning, about, you know, finding meaning in your career, about creating a life that feels meaningful and that is of service and use to other people around you. I talk about those things a lot. Unfortunately, if you open with that conversation, less people listen. I mean, there are people who are interested in that right off the get-go, but most people are more concerned with utilitarian things about you know, how to kind of improve their situation from a material standpoint. So the book has both, and honestly, it was really just a marketing decision to focus around the money, because I thought that would get the most people interested in the message. But, you know, and everyone is interested in money to a certain degree. And I think most people can be made to be interested in all the more existential stuff if you kind of show them the whole picture of it, but it's usually not the best thing to lead with.
Did you ever consider self-publishing the book as an example of finding success in a non-traditional way?
So that's a great question. I have a long background as a writer. I've been in this game writing for most of my 20s. I have self-published books. It's funny. My feeling around publishing is that it is different than the way I think about education. My feeling around publishing is, if you can get a book deal, it's still good to go through the traditional route for a specific reason, which is that it's. I do notice in the publishing world that if you have, you know, a major publisher on the spine of your book, people listen to it more. It's still the way it works. And so if you have that option, I think it does make sense. Now, you might say, oh, well, you're a hypocrite. You're saying, you know, that works for publishing. Why shouldn't you have the spine of approval, you know, on your resume with, you know, Harvard or Princeton or Yale? You know, college never hurt anyone. Well, there's a big difference here. And I think it actually cuts to the heart of our conversation here is, I'm going to write the book either way, so it's going to take me the same amount of time to write the book. If I can have that extra credibility, you know, on the side with no extra time, and I actually get paid for it, you know, because that's great. But college is not cost-free. In fact, it's very expensive, and it takes a lot of time, four years for most, actually 5 years for most people, and some people it's even six. So it's not a cost-free way to get a little extra stamp on your resume. It's actually quite costly. So the question is never absolute advantage. It's always relative to the options. So I think that's actually what your UnCollege movement is all about, in my interpretation, is not telling kids what they should do or that they should drop out, but expanding the dialogue to show that there are options, there are alternatives here, there are ways to get the same value for less of the cost and less of the burden and expense. That's my take on what UnCollege is about.
Of your four years in college, what did you learn?
there's so many ways I can answer that. I learned very obscure theories about postmodernist aesthetics. I learned how to write papers decrying the capitalist system of commerce. I learned a lot about various philosophers that I will probably never read again, like Derrida and Foucault. One thing is, it's funny, the more elite, quote unquote, an education is in America, the more removed it is from actually making your way in the world. So it is very unlikely that I'm going to be able to need to deliver a highly reasoned analysis of Michel Foucault or Jacques Derrida in my future career, but for some reason that's what we focus on in these elite college educations, and I don't quite understand that. I mean, what's your sense as someone who's a rebel on this as to why there's almost, it seems like almost go out of their way in college to have you focus on things that are totally removed from what's actually going to be useful for you in the rest of your life. What's your sense of that?
Well, the thing is that for college professors, it's not totally removed. People in this country like to debate whether we should be going to college for job training or whether we should be going to college to get a liberal education. And my take on that is that we are going to college for job training. It's just that college is job training to be an academic.
Yes.
And if you want to be an academic, then by all means go to college.
Yeah. So,
I don't
think really
we need 19 million academics.
Exactly. So that's a really important point. There's a lot of things I could say on that. One, you and I disagree with this on some level, my view is if you really know that you want to go into law or medicine or engineering or accounting or any of those very traditional type careers, you probably do want to go to college. I still don't think much of what you'll learn there will be relevant to what you later do, and even the people in the profession admit that, but it's just one of those are fields that are highly tracked, and if you don't have the right check marks, you can get around it, but it's pretty damn hard. You've told me, Dale, there are ways to pass the bar without a degree in law, and it's probably possible. I think ultimately your most efficient way is to just go through the system and get the right stamp marks on your resume. That said, for any other field, you're right. You're exactly right. You're literally doing the things in college that will get you ahead if you are a college professor. It is job training to be a college professor. And there's a great TED Talk. Everyone on the call should see this if you haven't already seen it. Like, if you look up Ken Robinson, and the talk is called "Do Schools Kill Creativity?" And in that talk, he asks the question. He says, well, what is our education for? If an alien were to come and look at what our education system is for, what would they conclude? And he says, they'd have to conclude that it was the whole system from K through graduate school was designed to produce university professors, right? Because those are you learn how to do academic research. You learn how to write academic papers. You learn how to speak and think in academic discourse, which is mostly relevant to academic professors. So it's this very, very strange system. I mean, that's if I accomplish one thing with my book and one thing with this call, It's to get people to kind of see the water we're swimming in, and it's very strangely colored water. It's like it's bizarre that we straightjacket. I mean, think of all the things that kids could be learning. Think, you know, they could be learning how to build things, how to solve problems, how to, you know, build businesses, how to be creative, how to be healthy, how to have great relationships, how to be leaders, how to be public speakers, how to be, you know, fit and healthy and not be one of the 50% of Americans that's obese. You know, all these things that will be very valuable to them and to us in our life, we could be learning. But instead, we're like stuck crouched over a desk, stuck taking tests, medicating kids to, you know, so that they can concentrate. I mean, this is an insane system where we medicate kids for being kids. Like kids, if last time I checked, kids run around and kids, you know, they're unruly and they yell and they play and they laugh and they get into mischief and cause trouble. That sounds to me like being a kid. But as soon as you do that in a classroom, you're not a kid. You're a case of ADD, and you need to be medicated, and you need to be given Ritalin and, you know, Xanax and, you know, Prozac and all these things that they're giving kids, not because there's anything wrong with the kids, but it's like fitting a round peg in a square hole. Like, we're trying to fit kids into a hole that they really shouldn't be fit into, and it's a completely insane system that is obviously breaking down at this point. And I think my book and your UnCollege movement is coming at the point where people are starting to realize that this system is insane and it's breaking down.
One of the questions I get all the time is, well, that's all fine and dandy, but it's only for the 1% of the population. What do you say to people who think that
right,
making a million or $1 billion or hacking
okay,
their education
so we have
is just
to, perfect. Good, yeah, very good question. So we have to distinguish between education and babysitting. So if a kid needs babysitting, then they need babysitting. If they have motivation problems, if they're left to their own devices, are going to be, you know, just sitting around taking bong hits and playing video games. You know, if they need babysitting, then they need babysitting. But let's not call that education. Education, most education that's actually going to matter is self-education. I mean, if you think about the things that actually, I mean, everyone on the call, think about the things you learn, not just academic things, but everything in your life that has been valuable to you. Maybe you've learned some amazing skills on your career. Maybe you've learned to play an instrument, and that's given you an enormous amount of joy in your life, is playing that instrument. Maybe you have a great relationship and you've learned how to have a fantastic relationship. Maybe you've learned how to be a great parent. You know, these are the kinds of things that give us meaning and joy in our lives, and it's all self-education. So in my view, the best thing a teacher can do is point you in the right direction. So if that whole thing about, oh, this is only useful for the kids who are self-motivated, well, that's fine. I have no problem talking to only to those people. Like, if you're self-motivated, you do not need this basically giant system of babysitting that we've set up at huge expense to ourselves and our kids and everyone. But, I mean, that's the way we should think about it, is that we parents are freaked out about their kids' unruliness. They're untrusting of their kids' ability to fend for themselves and get their own education doing things, you know, on the internet. Think about all the education that's available to kids just by surfing the internet and, you know, checking out TED Talks and learning about programming and all the social media things that kids are learning about today. But parents are freaked out that it's kind of unruly and they can't control the system. So they essentially have created this giant system of babysitting, which, you know, puts kids through bureaucratized, systematized, complex, which kind of makes sure that they don't get into too much trouble. So, you know, they have authority figures there who are making sure that they're not, you know, strung out on drugs, or they're not just slacking off and doing nothing. But the problem is it makes sure there's not trouble, but it also makes sure there's not greatness. Because if you look at anyone who's achieved anything truly great, they do not do it by following orders. Almost by definition, if there were orders to do it, it's not really great because it's already been thought out and figured out exactly how to do it. Anything you want to achieve that is great for yourself is kind of off the beaten track and can't be done by following orders or filling in little bubbles on a test. So we throw the baby out with the bathwater. We get the babysitting where the kids aren't getting into trouble, but we also kind of ensure that they won't be reaching the highest levels of creativity because we got to fit them into these boxes to make sure that they're safe and out of trouble.
We just had a question come in on Twitter, and that is, how does the changing paradigm of education relate to the economy?
How does it
I'm guessing that the context for that question is in terms of how education correlates to greater earnings. And Samuel Solomon is wondering how changing the paradigm of formal education to informal education will relate to the productivity of the economy.
Great question. So a couple of points around that. One, if you get into this dialogue at all, you are bound to hear the statistics promoted by the College Board, which is the nonprofit organization that makes the SATs, about the earning levels of people with various degrees. So the statistics are roughly, if you have just a high school diploma, you earn roughly a median of $33,000. If you have a college degree, it bumps up about 50 or 60% up to like $53,000, and then it goes up from there. If you have a master's, the median is somewhere in the 60s. If you have a PhD, the median, I think, is in the 70s or 80s. So people see that, and they're like, well, that's proof right there. If you don't have a college degree, you're going to be stuck with that $33,000, and who wants that? Well, there's many, many, many problems with those statistics. The most obvious one is that correlation does not equal cause. So, I mean, the people who are promoting these statistics are violating
Michael,
like, the first
I think
thing
you might learn. You might want to explain the difference between correlation and causation.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to get into that in a second. Yeah. So the people who are promoting those statistics are violating like the basic first thing you learn in like the first day of class in a college statistics class, which I have taken, by the way. So I learned this stuff in college statistics, which is the difference between correlation and cause. So, for example, here's the kind of problems that you can get into with this distinction between correlation and cause. Let's say you wanted to be taller. You know, I'm 5'9". I wouldn't mind being 6'1". In fact, I wouldn't mind being 6'6". There's many advantages on many levels that come from being taller. So let's say I want to be taller. Well, I can look around and see who are the tall people in the world. Well, there's a lot of tall people who are in the NBA and who play basketball. So you know what? The tall people tend to play basketball, and I want to be taller. Therefore, I should go basketball because the tall people are the ones who play basketball. Well, that's the exact same problem with that college statistic. It's confusing. There's a correlation between people who are in the NBA and who are tall, but the causality has gone the wrong way. In fact, you could make an argument. It's not the playing basketball that causes the tallness. In fact, you could argue it's probably the other way around, that the tallness makes it more likely that you'll be good at basketball. So the same kind of issue comes up around these education statistics, where if you're looking at people who have gone to college and they earn more. Well, what does that say about you if you've gone to college? It says probably you're a pretty disciplined person. You're probably on the higher end of the bell scale of intelligence. You probably have motivation. you're probably fairly well behaved. You know, you don't get into too much trouble, although that's changing a lot in today's college environment. So there's all these things that correlate with going to college, which are not themselves caused by going to college. It just happens that in our society, people who have those traits go to college. But there hasn't really been a lot of study done on, well, what happens if you have those traits and you don't go to college? And so there's not a lot of good data on that. But my informal, unscientific belief is that if you have all those traits, the motivation, the intelligence, the will to succeed, the discipline, the ability to stay out of trouble, and you don't go to college, you know, you're going to do just fine. So, you know, you may not be able to become a doctor or a lawyer, but there's a lot of other ways to live a happy, successful life than being a doctor or a lawyer.
There is one really important data point that supports what you just said, and that is that there was a study done at Princeton 2 years ago that found that even if you apply to Harvard, are rejected, and instead attend some other institution or don't go at all, you still achieve the same earning potential as someone who actually went to and graduated from Harvard, which just goes to show that that college has self-select talent. It's about whether you believe that you should go to Harvard, not whether you should actually go.
Yes, exactly. Now, there could be problems there because someone could read that statistic and say, oh, well, I'm going to apply to Harvard. If I apply to Harvard, I get to be more successful in life. Well, not exactly. There's a phenomenon that's relevant here called Goodhart's Law, Goodhart, Goodhart's Law. You can look it up on Wikipedia. And it's essentially a dynamic that someone observed in analyzing the Soviet Union, where in the Soviet Union, and I think there's actually a lot of parallels between the Soviet Union and our education system in terms of the massive amounts of bureaucracy that are involved. So if you look in the Soviet Union, everything was decreed everything was organized by decree. So they would have very specific regulations that would say, okay, we want these exact specifications for this certain type of part for this kind of tank, for example. And they'd kind of list the specifications. And then what would happen is the manufacturers who don't really have a lot of incentives other than just to meet to check the check mark that they have gotten those specifications right, would do like that exact specification, but would mess up in 5 or 6 other ways. But just as long as like the 3 things that were specified on the list were met, then it worked. But the part could have like 10 other problems with it, and it was fine. So the point of this Goodhart's Law is sort of that your life actually evolves to fit the specifications you're making around that. So the analogy here with education is that if we're trying to test people's motivation and ability and skills with these very narrowly defined tests, we actually get a situation where kids' entire lives are being shaped and molded just to fit these tests, whereas the tests were supposed to, we've got it backwards. It's not our lives that are supposed to be shaped to do well on the tests. It was that the tests were supposed to measure how well we were doing in these areas in our lives. But because so many outcomes are being based on these tests, like which college you're going to go into, you know, which entry-level job you're going to get in our system, we kind of shape our entire lives from age 6 right through 22 to fit through these pigeonholes. And that's where the title of our talk, Deschooling Your Mind, comes in. Because we all of us, I don't care at what point you dropped out of school, whether I didn't go on to get graduate education, but I dropped out from the track of getting graduate education, whereas you, Dale, dropped out of college. And, you know, some people I interviewed dropped out of high school. But all of us have been strongly schooled in this system from a young age, in a system that's essentially designed to fit us in to do well on these measuring rods, these tests, which were actually designed to test how well our life is going, but instead we've shaped our life to fit the test. So we've got it exactly backwards, and that's where the whole concept of de-schooling your mind comes in, is sort of unplugging from this crazy matrix that we've created for ourselves.
Michael, have you read Evan Illich's books, De-Schooling Society, that was published in 1971?
I'm aware of them, but I have not read them, actually. So I obviously should, because the title of our talk is related to them. Tell me about that one, De-Schooling Society.
De-Schooling Society came out of a lot of work that John Holt did in the 60s and 50s in New York. John Holt was an educator, and he asked the question that most educators do when they go about improving something, which is the question that you really ask when you go about improving anything, which is, how do you make something better? And he was asking, how do we make school better?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he coined the term unschooling by asking, mm-hmm. what are the outcomes of school, and what's the most efficient way to get there? How can we have the most effective outcomes? And that work was done throughout the 50s and 60s. And then even Illich wrote this book, De-Schooling Society, 1971, which was basically his thesis about how school was formed to support the industrial complex. He talks about how the institutionalization of education is considered to institutionalize society, and conversely that his ideas for deinstitutionalizing education may be a starting point for deinstitutionalizing society in such a way that we can enable people to live happy, productive lives. I was just going to point out that interestingly he went farther than just critiquing. And actually made suggestions for solutions and talked about things like peer learning networks and other things that, you know, we see now existing on the internet.
Yeah. So, yeah, sounds fascinating. I should absolutely read that. I have read a fair amount of radical critiques of higher education. One problem that I see in a lot of it is a somewhat conspiratorial tone. So often you'll hear things like, you know, the school system was just designed to make, you know, compliant factory workers to fit into the capitalist system. And I think there's like some truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. I think that what actually is going on is much more complex, in that it's a system. We have a whole system of things that fits together to create what we have right now. So one of the pieces of the system, funny enough, is the whole concept of retirement. Now that may sound funny. We're talking about kids at the beginning of their lives. Why would retirement be relevant to that? Well, we have a system that believes that you should work really, really hard up until 65 and save enough money during that time, have like a stable job where you're saving up, saving enough that you can then spend the next, you know, 20 years or so in this thing called retirement. Well, living 20 years without working requires a lot of cash saved up. You can invest it, but we've all seen what investments, you know, are doing these days. So, you know, you're talking about diverting a huge amount of your income into this pool that you're going to hopefully live from for 20 years after retirement. Well, what think of all the things that follow from that. If you are aiming for 20 years of retirement where you don't have to work, that means you have to work your ass off in the earlier 40 years, and you can't take a lot of risks. Like, you've got to just, like, show up to work and get a stable job and get that 401k and get your benefits and, you know, put your 10% pre-tax earnings into your thing, like, year after year after year. Well, that's a certain type of existence. Many, many people have that and it works for them. I don't mean to bash it here, but it's the only thing that we've been told about or offered. And if that's the existence you want, then you do have to get all these check marks. Like, you have to get the right resume, right stuff on your resume so you get that corporate job, so you can fit into that box and get those retirement benefits. But think of all the things that flow from think of all the things that change if instead of saying, okay, I want to spend 20 years of my life, you know, playing golf at the end of my life, or, you know, think if you give up that idea and instead you say, you know what, I want to find something that I can do now that I am so that pays my bills now and that I'm so passionate about that I want to do it till the day I die. I love this so much that it doesn't even feel like work. And in fact, I'm not really working because I'm doing what I love. And I've actually found that. I am making my living as a book author, and it wasn't easy. It took me a long time to build up this life for myself, but I will do this till the day I die. I love what I'm doing. I'm not becoming a gazillionaire doing it, but I'm comfortable. I'm not worried about money. And it's working for me. And to me, the idea of retirement is insane. Like, why would I want to retire from what I love? So once you have that shift in perspective, you can take some more risks, because it's like, okay, you're in it for the long run. You're trying to find that thing that you can do till you're 80 or 90 or 100. You know, so you don't have to be so worried about, you know, racking up your 401k, you know, year after year after year. So, you know, we have this whole system where we have this retirement, then we have a whole another piece of the puzzle is the way we do job screening. So you want the retirement, so you got to get your job to get the 401k to have the retirement. So you've got to do all the things that will get you into the job. Well, our job screening system, like if you try to get a job these days, something you'll see a lot is BA required, master's preferred. BA required, master's preferred. So if you think about it, like nothing you learned in school is for your BA is usually required to do those jobs. I mean, you're not going to have to write a paper on Aristotle, you know, in your job. So what are they saying when they say BA required, MA preferred? What they're saying is we want someone who is motivated, bright, has discipline, listens to authority, can follow orders, has basic writing and communicating skills, and doesn't cause too much trouble. So that's great. Those are all important, you know, important attributes for a job. But you know, the problem is you don't need to have a BA to have those things. You can just have them. The reason the BA required thing has come into place is merely and purely for the convenience of the job screeners. So it's not evil. They're not wrong. I mean, if you've ever placed an employment ad, you get like 500 responses for one position. So they just need a quick way to like weed people out. They need to see, okay, we know that if everyone has a BA, at least they have some minimum level of discipline and intelligence. So we're just going to weed out all the people who don't. So it's purely for convenience. But again, that only matters if you're trying to plug into that tracked system where you're getting a very tracked job. You're going into this whole retirement 401k system. So my point with all this is that it's a massive system that has evolved. I'm not sure there's a conspiracy to have put it in place, but it has evolved. And I'm, with my book, and I think with you, with your movement, are trying to get people to see the system as a whole and to feel empowered to unplug from it, to unplug from the matrix, and create more freedom in their lives. Dale, we've got a lot of questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Go right ahead.
Yeah, we have some really cool questions here on the question board. So if you are listening via Skype or webcast, there should be a little box at the lower left of your screen there where you logged in, that you could submit a question. We have some good ones here that we'll get to. If you're listening by phone, we have a bunch of people on phone out there, press star two, to raise your hand. We have one hand raised there. I'm going to go for a moment to the questions online here. Here's a good one and a pretty common one I get. So So what are the primary causes, not correlations, of success for these millionaires and billionaires? That's a great question. So I've been talking to a lot of very successful people the last 2 years. I've talked to some famous people, Sean Parker, the founding president of Facebook, creator of Napster, creator of Spotify Music, ServiceNow, Mark Echo, fashion designer, Matt Mullenweg, the creator of WordPress, really, really driven, successful people. So what are the causes, not correlations? I would say that the most relevant cause I have seen is mindset, is a mindset shift in people, where at some point these people make a decision, I will do whatever it takes to be successful. And part, this is really important, part of whatever it takes is I will do whatever it takes to find out the things I need to learn to be successful. So the people I interviewed are highly motivated to educate themselves. They just go cut straight to the chase. Like they don't just assume that they're going to get the education they need to be successful in some pre-packaged curricula that is, you know, fed to them and 2 million other people that year in the education system. They know I will do whatever it takes. I'll go out and find the education I need. So it's about, it's really a motivational thing. It's having the motivation to say, you know, I will sift through 50 books if I have to find that one nugget that's going to get me ahead. I will, you know, go to 20 workshops and, you know, one of them will be exactly what I need. And that's enough for me. If the other 19 are crap, as long as I get that one that puts you on the right path, that can change the rest of my life forever. So it's just, it's very, intense motivation to learn, to constantly learn what they need to know. So, you know, people say, oh, you're against education. You probably get this a lot too, Dale. You know, how can you be so against education? No, on the contrary. Education is everything. Like, you will not succeed without education. You will not succeed without learning. I'm just questioning the mode of delivery of education. And the people that I interviewed went out and got their education informally. They went out and they were masters of just finding street smart education, finding mentors, getting themselves in situations where there was a very high learning quotient. So that's a really important point here is, you know, in the different situations you're in, whether it's work or relationships, you know, you always want to be asking, how much am I really learning in this situation? And if you feel all of a sudden like you're in autopilot in this work situation or a relationship you have or in the activities you're involved with, that is a sign that you're not learning. And, you know, a lot of people, like Dale, you had this wonderful tweet just like an hour ago. Wait, let me pull it up. I want to read it for everyone. Let's see.
To which the response has been fabulous, by the way.
Yeah. Let's see. So Dale just tweeted out, quote, I feel comfortable and complacent. Any suggestions to make myself uncomfortable? I love this. I love this. Because here is, if you look at, like, what's the religion of our national policy, you know, planning? It's like comfort. It's like, let's make sure everyone has comfortable jobs, so they can just stay in their jobs and get their paychecks and get their retirement, and everyone can be nice and comfortable. Well, you know, that is great. If you're, like, starving, if you're on the streets, that's a great step up. I mean, that's, you know, it's better to be comfortable than, like, you know, on the brink of starvation. But once you're in the comfort level, that's not something to be clung on to. You shouldn't cling on to that. You should go beyond that and find ways to strategically make yourself uncomfortable by taking on bigger risks, you know, by doing things that you don't know how the hell you're going to do them, and by trying things where you could fall and, you know, fall on your ass if you try them, doing it in a structured way where you are taking measured risks. So I'm not talking about mortgaging your house and starting a business, you know, with your kid's future and all the money you're going to need to buy food, you know, mortgaged on this house. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. But, you know, I think you're a perfect example of this, Dale. Like, you are taking a lot of risks in your life. You're not getting the main thing that everyone else says you need to get, i.e. a college degree, to be successful. So that in itself is a risk. And you know, you're writing a book. It's your first time writing a book. That is a risk. Not everyone who starts a book finishes a book. I happen to think you will, but it's a risk. And so there's all these things you're doing that are making yourself uncomfortable and taking risks, but they're not, like, the cool thing is you're going to learn either way. Like, you're learning writing this book. No matter what the outcome of this book is, you're already winning because you're getting the learning from it. And you know, you have enough money flowing through your life where it's not like, we're not talking about, you know, hanging out on a yacht or flying private jets, but you have enough that, you know, that you know you're going to have shelter, and you know you're going to have food, and you know that you're going to have clothes, and you're going to have that basic level taken care of because of the basic amount of money you're earning. So once you're at that point where it's like you basically know that you're going to be able to pay rent and know that you're going to be able to have food, I mean, then if you're comfortable, you're really messing up because you're staying in a rut and you're not pushing yourself and you're not pushing yourself to learn. Why don't we take some questions from the phone people. So anyone here, I know we had one hand raised. Let me just get to that control panel here. So we have, if you are on the phone and would like to ask a question, press star 2. And we have someone by the name of Job, J-O-B, who has raised his hand. So let me unmute you here. So Job, you're on the line. Hello, are you there? Okay, maybe he dropped off. Anyone else out there on phone want to ask a question? I will go back to our Q&A Q&A questions on the online. But if you're on the phone, press star 2. So here's one. This is from Max in Providence. Oh, by the way, I went to Brown, so I know Providence well. So Max in Providence, how do you think we can change the benchmarks of education to better direct the efforts of students? That's a great question. So I promise some controversy here, and I'm going to deliver right now. I think for the most part, we should not be grading students. We should not be having them take tests. Basically, there really shouldn't be any benchmarks because if you – now, how can I say that? That's a very radical statement. If you look at what actually gets you to succeed in life, the benchmark is whether you succeed or not. So if you're trying to be successful in romance, the benchmark is whether – there's not a test you can take that says that you're good at romance. The benchmark is whether – someone says yes to a date. The benchmark is whether you're in a great relationship. The benchmark is whether eventually you get married. So there's no test. Imagine taking a test, like, oh, you have passed the test, and now we know for certain that you are great in relationships. No, we know for certain whether you're in a relationship or not and whether it's great. And everything else is like that. Imagine taking a test saying, well, you have passed the test, and now we know for certain that you're going to make money in your life. Well, actually, we don't. There's no amount of test taking you can take that could predict that with any amount of fidelity. The only way we can really know is if you actually go out and do it. Same thing with health. Imagine taking a test. You know, you got an A in health. We know you're going to be healthy because you got an A in your health class. Actually, no. You're healthy if you're healthy. You're healthy if you learn how to have a good exercise routine and eat the right foods and, you know, not take drugs or too many drugs. the benchmarks are the results themselves. So I think what we should be doing is having kids go out and do things that actually are meaningful to themselves and to other people. So think about it. Most of what we do in our education system is not intrinsically valuable either to the kids or to anyone else. Like, if you're studying, you know, a bunch of facts to parrot that back on a test, that's not really that helpful to you because you're going to forget the facts, and you're unlikely to take those tests in the future once you're out of school, and it's certainly not helping anyone else. Well, what if we took that same kid and said, here are a bunch of people in our community who don't have food, and here are some ways we think we can get them food. Why don't you come up with a plan we're going to give you a budget, and you come up with a plan of how we can feed these hungry people in your community. Here are the resources. Now you go to it. And then you have the kids do that, and then either they fail or they succeed, and either way, they reflect on it. And they've tried something that's meaningful to them because they're learning about something that they're probably care about or excited about. It's helping people in the community. And the benchmark is whether they actually succeeded in getting this project off the ground or not. You know, same thing, starting a business. The benchmark is whether the business succeeds or not. And frankly, you learn either way. So I know that's very radical to say we shouldn't have grades and tests, but that's basically my view on this whole thing. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dale?
This has been one of my frustrations with the Open Badges project that the Mozilla and Hewlett Foundations are supporting. They've started a project to create an infrastructure to basically create a new form of credentialing through what they're calling badges. And my issue with that is that ultimately all they're doing is creating a new type of credential, which will get to be just as exclusive and elusive as college degrees are now. Some types of credentials are going to be worth more than others, and we're going to end up in the same paradox that we're in. That said, we still need ways to evaluate people, right? But I think increasingly how people are being evaluated is not based on what they know, which is measured by a test, but based on what they can actually do. We're seeing companies like StackHub and GitHub and Stack Overflow or Crop and Behance for technical and creative professions, giving people a way to demonstrate their knowledge. And it wouldn't surprise me if we see apprenticeships coming back, where people are, and it's already the case that, you know, if you do well in an internship, you're often offered a job. I wouldn't be surprised if we see more and more of that type of system.
Yeah. Now, we have a couple of questions, hands raised. We'll get to them in a moment. I want to make one point on what you just said because I think it's very important. So everyone kind of gets that this is insane to make people go through 16 years of formal education, possibly take out, you know, tens or even hundreds of $100,000 in debt to get this education, college education, spend 4 years just to have like a screening tool to say, hey, this kid has some basic motivation, discipline, and intelligence. Let's let him have a job. And that's an insane system. It's completely fucking insane. And I think a lot of people are starting to realize that. So what has come up, and you just alluded to this, is efforts to say, okay, well, let's just test their skills directly. If you don't need to go through this huge educational process to prove that you have the skills, let's just show a way that kind of gives you the check mark directly whether you have the skills. Well, the problem with that is that it's really optimized for something called the formal job market. So people out there, if you're interested in this topic, you should do some Googling on the topic of the informal job market versus the formal job market. Some other ways this gets expressed is the advertised versus the unadvertised job market, or the publicized versus the unpublicized job market. So most of the time when we think, oh, I need to get a job, someone, you know, is fresh out of college. I did this. I applied for a bunch of jobs my senior year of college. I got rejected from all of them, but I did apply. You go and you think, okay, I need a job. Let me go look on Craigslist. Let me go look on Monster. Let me go to the career fair. Let me go to my college's career services department, and I'll look for a job and I'll apply. Well, that's what's called the formal job market or the advertised job market. It's all jobs that are publicly available to apply for. And the best estimates out there is that only 20% of jobs that actually end up getting filled are filled through this form. So 20% of jobs, of positions that get filled by someone who has responded to a job ad, submitted a resume cold, and gotten interviews and gotten hired. So how are the other 80% getting filled? Well, they're happening on what's called the informal job market. And the informal job market is how most people get jobs. And if you reflect, it is actually probably how you've gotten any jobs that you've had, all you out there on the call. And that is, you know someone who has a business, and you're talking to them, and they say they have a problem with such and such, and you say, oh, I could help you with that, and they offer you a job. Or somebody knows somebody who needs help with something, and you can be useful to that, and you somehow, through that connection, get offered a job. So 80% of jobs come in informally through connections, through networking. Oftentimes, the position doesn't even exist. I mean, this has happened to me more than once for freelance gigs I've had where I've been on retainer, and they said, look, we don't really have this position created, but we want your help in our business. We know you can add value, so we're going to create a part-time position for you so that you can add your value to this organization. That's all informal job market. So that's 80% of the jobs are filled that way. And, like, all these little credentialing schemes are completely worthless. Like, imagine one of these jobs that I got through a connection, and it's like a friend of a friend, and I've come well vouched for, and they know that I can add value. And I say, oh, but you know, just in case you're not sure, let me show you my little badge system. And look, I have these gold stars, and I have these little red stars that show that I know how to do da-da-da. Like, they would laugh me out of the room. It would hurt my job prospects to do that. So all of these, like, star systems and credential systems are based for the advertised job market, which if you have applied for a job recently, you should have probably figured out is not where you should be putting your attention. I mean, I put an ad for, like, a part-time assistant on Craigslist, you know, for $10 an hour part-time, and I get, like, 100 responses, and most of the people have BAs. I've had people with masters from Harvard reply to $10 an hour jobs. So that's the advertised job market. It's a very unpleasant place to try to stake out your economic future compared to the unadvertised job market. So let's take some more questions. Let's see who we've got here.
I do want to interject, Michael.
Oh, okay.
A couple weeks ago, the New York Times ran a Sunday feature called Generation Limbo, talking about the current class of college graduates who are just graduating from college and are finding themselves working as bartenders and collecting welfare checks.
Yeah.
And the same day that I read that article, I got literally three job offers come into my inbox.
Yeah.
And the stark contrast was just amazing.
Yeah. And we're going to get to questions one second. You keep saying things I need to respond to. So people out there, and this is one of the questions on the virtual format, is like, okay, great, you're saying all this stuff, but how do you actually go out and do it? Well, it may sound kind of flip, but my book is basically, that's what I talk about in my book, is okay, you're not going to continue your education. Maybe you're not going to get a BA, or if you have a BA, maybe you're not going to get a master's. So what do you actually need to learn to make your way without those credentials? And I talk about the specific skills you need to learn. And these aren't job training skills. This isn't learning. Like, that's a big misconception, is we're not talking about job training here. The whole idea of job training is idiotic, because most jobs that are going to exist in 5 years don't exist right now. I mean, think about, like, if you go to a conference these days, like, 50% of the people you meet are, like, social media consultants. Have you noticed that? Like, if you go to a conference, like, everyone you meet is like, oh, yeah, I'm a social media consultant. Like, I run a social media firm. I'm not trying to bash those people. I'm just saying that didn't exist 5 years ago. That is an entire profession that is taking up, like, half, like, is offering, like, half the jobs of the young people I meet these days that didn't exist 5 years ago. So the whole idea of job training is idiotic, because you couldn't have trained for that job 5 years ago. You just have to train for it informally as it arises. So I'm not talking about job training. I'm talking about skills of success. And those skills are very specific. They are networking, learning how to build a good network, getting clear on your purpose and mission, like getting clear on what value you want to provide on the planet and what difference you want to make, learning sales. You know, sales is a universal skill. Even if you're never going to sell a product or service for money, you're going to have to sell your ideas. You know, if you're in the nonprofit world, you absolutely have to learn sales because you're selling an idea, you're selling a vision, and you're selling the idea of people donating to your cause and getting involved with your cause. So sales, I talk about marketing. Again, that's the one that has a dirty word associated with it, but there's high integrity ways to think about marketing, and that is another one of these real-world skills. And if you get all of these in place, if you are have a great network and you're really clear on your vision and you're really clear on how to persuade people to get excited by your vision, which is sales, and you learn how to market, which is how to get your ideas out and diffuse through the world, you're going to be – all you out there are going to be like Dale and like me. Like we – like constantly are turning down work. I know I am. I know you are. I mean, think about that. Dale is 19. He's, you know, 3 years younger than most of his peers who when they graduate college, and he's already turning down very lucrative work. Like, why is that? Is it because Dale is a genius? Well, I do think he is a genius, but there's a lot of geniuses who are broke. It's because Dale learned actual skills about how to provide value in the real world. And once you do that, there is no recession. It's like, recession? What recession? I haven't noticed there was a recession. I mean, I know that sounds flip, but I haven't noticed personally. I've read about it, but I haven't personally noticed there's a recession. I'm busier than ever. And it's not because I'm some, you know, brilliant genius. It's because I focused on learning these real world skills. And that's what I write about, these skills in my book. So let's take some questions. We have, let's see here, someone from Harleysville, Pennsylvania, starting with a 215 area code from Harleys, Pennsylvania. You are live on the line. Do we have you there? Ooh, crickets. All right. We are not having much luck with these star twos. If you are on the line, star two will raise your hand. Let's go back to the questions on the question board. That's pretty active right now. We've got a lot of questions there. So we just had, how can you create your own job opportunities? I just answered that one. Basically, buy my book, and it has all the answers in there. Let's see. Another one, what's the most efficient use of the informal job market? I actually have a long blog post about that. That is about to come out this week. If you kind of stay on top of my Twitter and my Facebook, Google me, Michael Ellsberg, get on my Twitter and my Facebook, I'm going to be talking, have a very long, detailed article this week about how to succeed in the informal job market, which is the one you should be paying attention to if you want a job. Let's see here. What else do we got here? Okay, here's an interesting one. Should there be an end goal in mind for pursuing self-directed learning to be successful? That's a really important question. This whole question of goals and what is the goal? So basically, and you alluded to this at the beginning of the call, Dale, you know, why do you really talk about money? Money is only one measure of success. And I mentioned I basically, the title of my talk is focused on that because that's the one I think that's going to get kind of wake people up the most and listen to what we're talking about. But as we all know, you can be rich and be miserable, and that's not a successful life. If you're rich but you're lonely and spiteful and unhealthy, few people would call that a successful life. So success is a multi-dimensional phenomenon that has many aspects to it. And we could debate a lot about the finer points, but I think if we all talked about it, we would come up with some basic points about success. So I think in most people, you know, there could be people who disagree with this, but in most people's vision, their vision of a successful life includes mostly of the following things. It includes some sense of meaning or purpose in what you're doing. So if you just feel totally meaningless about what your life is about and the work you do, you're probably not going to feel successful. So there's a sense of meaning and purpose. There is relationships are a really important part. I think most people, there are exceptions, but most people want to be in a loving, committed relationship and to have love in a romantic relationship in their life over the long run. So there's a million ways that could look in your life, but most people want that. There's family life. Most people want to create a family. There are many who don't, but you know, most people want to have some sense of family in their life, whether they have kids or not. There is obviously money, and I'm not talking about being millionaires or billionaires here, but you know, I'm talking about just having money handled, where you're not constantly worried about money. Like Dale, I think you've got money handled. You know, you may not be a millionaire yet, but my experience with you is that you're just not that worried about money. Like, you're cool. You've got it handled. You've got your basics taken care of. You've got, you know, the stuff, you know, you basically just got that area handled, and it's not what you're focused on. So getting to that point, I think, is a part of success. And I think you're already successful there. You know, having some sense of spirituality, you know, most people, whether it's organized religion or not, you know, most people want to have some sense of connection to something greater than themselves. So there's all these areas where they're kind of threads that you weave together to create a successful life. Health is a big one. You know, if you're unhealthy, it's unlikely you're going to feel successful in your life. So getting your health in order, getting your eating and your fitness and your exercise in order, all those things. So those are the things. If you say, well, what should education accomplish? I think what it should accomplish is that young people are inspired, not forced, but inspired to learn the things they're going to need to learn to get those areas in their life handled. So they're inspired to learn about how to be great communicators and how to have, you know, how to communicate and be in relationship, whether, you know, obviously at a younger age it's not romantic, but be in relationship with people, be communicators, have communication skills. And later, when they get older, yes, like how to be in romantic, sexual relationship. Now, again, I'm not saying schools should teach these classes necessarily. I'm saying this is my conception of education in the broadest sense, like how young people should be brought into being a functioning, successful, happy adults. So, you know, relationships, being inspired to learn about health. I mean, think of, you know, if you've seen the movie Food, Inc., we're in a national crisis around health right now. The obesity level, childhood obesity levels are off the hook. You know, I don't know what it is exactly, but I think it's somewhere around 50% of kids are obese these days. And, you know, it's tied to our education system. Like, they're you know, eating junk during the school day and having to drink lots of soda just to stay awake because they have these long hours of classes, and they're, like, hunched over their desks taking tests instead of, like, being out and being active and playing and, you know, being in the sunshine and getting fresh air. So the school system is definitely a negative cause of that health one for them, for kids. So all these areas, it's a holistic conception of success, and it's nowhere to be found in our education system. Now, again, I'm not saying all of a sudden we should have courses in this, because most of the stuff you can only learn in the real world. Like, I mean, here's a paradox. Like, take running a business, for example. You know, if someone is teaching, there are exceptions, but if someone is in a class teaching a class on how to start and run a business, it's not likely that they're very successful doing that, because if they were successful at it, they'd be running a business. They wouldn't be getting a paycheck teaching how to run a business. And I know, I mean, I there's probably educators on the line, and I'm not trying to, you know, to knock that, you know, there's that stereotype, like those who don't know how to do things teach or something. But in certain areas, it's true. Like, if you want to learn about how to start a business, you have to learn from people who are out in the field running businesses. Those are the ones who know how to do that. So I'm not talking necessarily about having courses in formalized classes about these real world skills. I'm talking about encouraging kids to get excited about learning these skills for themselves in the real world. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dale?
I think there's a point at which you have to learn how to translate those book smarts into street smarts.
Too often, so much of what happens in the classroom is like a trip to Vegas. It seems as though both students and teachers agree that what happens in the classroom stays in the classroom. Students will write their theoretical abstract essays, and professors will grade them just to keep up the facade. And I think that what Michael's book gets to the heart of is how to take those steps, those first faltering steps, out from behind your desk and into the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get on the line here. Let's get some more questions going. We've got a good dialogue here. Who has their hand raised? Okay, let's try Harleysville, Pennsylvania one more time here. So 215 area code from Harleysville, Pennsylvania. You are on the line. Do we have you there? Hello, anyone, person who just pressed, wow, we're having trouble with this hand-raising thing. Whoever just raised their hand, let me see here. I got it. Okay, I'm sorry, okay. Hello, Harleysville, Pennsylvania, are you there?
Hello,
215 area code. Yeah, we got you now. Thanks so much.
All right, okay, I wasn't ignoring you guys. So I wanted to express some skepticism.
Go for
not
it.
Necessarily
we love skepticism.
Not about the ideas. I've been my whole life has been pretty much in line with the ideas you're expressing. I'm a senior in high school. I got homeschooled last year because I was sick of the public schooling system. I've done programming since I was 13 years old. So, I mean, and I've fallen in love with TED. So all these ideas, they're very much intimate to me. So my question to you is, what applications do these ideas have to changing the educational policy that so it can have a greater effect on more people? Because I think every student should have the opportunity to experience new ideas and improve their creativity and such.
Right. Great question. So if I understand it correctly, it's you're essentially asking like how can we make sure that more people have this?
What can be done on the bigger national level to make this more prevalent?
So there's the topic of the call is de-schooling our minds, and it's really about mental habits that we get caught in that get us caught in ruts. And there's one specific mental habit that I think is highly related to the question you just asked there. And that is the habit of, like, if we decide that something is desirable, you know, therefore we should create an institution and a policy and a report and a commission that promotes that thing. That's a certain way of thinking where you decide some outcome in society is desirable. Like, let's say I'll just use another example. Let's say we want, kids to be less obese, so we want them to eat less sugar. So let's create a commission and an advertising campaign and a curriculum in schools, and that is an institutional way of thinking that
agree with the institutional methods of making them happen. I think starting grassroots movements would be a way to do this. But
So we're not talking about institutions. So
no.
It already is happening. I actually think we don't need to worry about it because it's happening in a major way right now. This is a tidal wave that's happening. I mean, I'm 34. I first got on the internet at age 19, 18, my freshman year of college. It was the first time I ever experienced the internet. That was 95, so it was right when the internet was becoming commercially available. So there is now, you know, people your age and Dale's age are, you know, grew up essentially your entire lives with the internet. And
right.
They call them digital natives, internet natives.
Right, right.
So the people I meet your age are getting their information online. So by definition, that is informal education. I mean, it's peer-to-peer. You are, you know, you love a TED Talk, and so you share it with your friends on Twitter and Facebook. And you found some really cool blog content that you think can help your friends achieve what they want to achieve. So you share it, you share it with people through your social networks. So I actually think that system is in place, and that's actually what's causing the current tidal wave right now of questioning education.
Right, right.
It's like you can get a great, if you spent a year just sitting down and watching TED Talks and like talking about them with people online,
you can
like, that would
so
be an incredible
more.
Education. What's that?
I think the problem is that there's so much time wasted in the formal educational setting, and
yes.
I'm still in it. I just returned to it from homeschool last year, and
yes.
it is miserable. And what's different about it this year is that I'm accepting it, but the fact that so many students, so many kids are subject to that kind of detrimental
yes.
Education.
Is a great...
I don't think it's real education.
Yes.
So,
so
I think
the point
I think,
here, yeah. So go ahead.
I think uh-huh. public education is not doing its job. It's not educating. So by de-schooling, I think you're fixing those problems after the fact. But to me, I want to do something right now. I want my classes to change. I want to be able to do something with my life. And I know other people do too.
Right. So, yeah, I think you just...
Can I ask quickly, why you went back into the public school system?
It was... social reasons and organizational reasons. I think the organizational reasons, I feel also lie in the heart of public schooling. I think public schooling, maybe this is a hypothesis of mine. I think that by being in public school for so long, it sort of took my opportunities away to become self dependent, to be able to fend for myself and organize myself. I think going to school every single day and being told, go to this class, do this, it took that away
yeah.
from me. So I struggled through my year last year.
Yeah, that is a really, really important point. Because so what we need is not like some commission that's going to, you know, give a plan
yeah.
to teach this material in classes. What we need is less fucking schooling, like less homework, less
exactly.
you know, less hours
but,
crunched over classes. Like that is keeping. So there's two kind of kids basically that I want to talk about. Like there's like I think a lot of kids get put through the schooling system with the kind of idea of like, well, let's keep them off the streets. You know, keep them off the streets and they'll stay away
yeah.
from drugs. And if someone is really going to get into a lot of trouble, then probably being in school could be a way to keep them out of trouble. So that's kind of one type of kid that I'm not really talking about here. But I'm talking about people like you who are obviously self-motivated. You obviously want to make something of your life. You're not going to be, quote-unquote, getting into trouble on the streets, you know, if you don't have 8 hours of schooling a day. And you are like, I hear it in your voice. You're like, give me the freedom.
I am begging,
stuff.
Honestly.
Yeah.
I have an example. I was having a conversation with this great teacher. That's the other thing. I found teachers are not – there are bad teachers and good teachers, but the good teachers are so valuable. I've had some really good teachers
yeah.
this year, which I'm grateful for. But I was having a conversation with one of these really great teachers about public education and basically the same kind of conversation we're having right now. And
yeah.
I was a minute late for my next class, and
yeah.
I'm being punished. She, one more late and I get a detention. So basically,
right.
The education system is punishing me for
Right, and the reason they're punishing you is because they think you were late because you were, like, goofing off. So it makes no distinction there. And it's like this cookie-cutter system where, as I've been saying, to keep the kids from, you know, being on the street and getting into problems, they also keep kids from doing the kind of thing that you want to do, which is, you know, being on the Internet and learning all this stuff that you're learning. And so I would say, I mean, I don't, in my book, I stay away from recommending to people whether they go to college or not.
Right.
And probably I would need to talk with you more, you know, to really get a sense what the best choice is for you. But just from the basic conversation we're having here, it sounds to me like you should be considering not going to college. I mean, it sounds to me like you are the kind of person who could achieve what Dale is achieving by not going to college.
I think I could, but what I want to pursue is also I'm looking at liberal arts education, so
mm-hmm.
Want that sort of – I want to be around people. That's the thing about college. You're
mm-hmm.
– at least the colleges I'm looking at. I want to be around people who think
mm-hmm.
just like me – not just like me, but I want to be exposed to new ideas and deep thinkers, and that's what I want. I want a community like that.
Yeah.
And
well, you can definitely
I don't
get that
see
in college.
That outside of – I don't see that outside of college. I don't.
The other option is to move to a city.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, you can get that. You can definitely get that in college. But Dale just hit it on the head. I mean, I'm around a lot of. I live in New York. You know, I'm around a lot of deep thinkers right now, and we're not in college. So, so let's thank you so much, and good luck to you. And
yep, no problem.
Let's take. We have. I figured out. I think I had a problem with the star system, the star two thing, but it's working now. So we have one more on the line here from Pasadena, California, area code 626 from Pasadena, California. You are live on air there. Do we have you?
Yes, I believe so.
Hi there. Yep. Hi.
Yes, I've been listening to this with so much interest. Dale, we've been communicating on the unschooling conference. A couple of the points I wanted to bring up and ask were addressed
mm-hmm.
so well by your last caller. And one of those questions is the extent to which it's possible outside the loop, outside of official education, to create that same kind of educational environment which so many of us have really enjoyed inside education. Most of my education took place in the dormitory, not in the classroom. And in
yes.
fact, I ended up teaching college for a number of years in subjects that I had never taught because I learned them in the dormitory.
Yeah.
And some people have found that there's so much value to education. I think you both feel the same thing. But the question is, how can one present something like that? How can one create an alternative that will allow people to have the community and, to some extent, perhaps the recognition for having achieved their education without going
yeah.
through the process?
Great. That's a great great question. So I want to make an analogy here that I think will clarify a lot for people in the way they think about education. It's related to the question you just asked. So imagine someone is hungry and starving and is not properly nourished and needs food. And you go to that person and you say, I've got exactly what you need. There's a cafeteria right over there. They've got standardized meals. Everything is made by a food plan. You're going to get the food you need, and you'll be nourished and not hungry. So that's great. The person goes. They get their food. They're not starving anymore. And then we say, hey, this works so well for this person who is starving. They got this cafeteria food. Now they're not starving. Therefore, everyone should eat at this one cafeteria. No one should ever go to any other restaurant whatsoever. This is the answer, this cafeteria right here. Well, that's the way we talk about education. We compare people who aren't learning at all, like, you know, dropouts who just go and work, you know, minimum wage jobs and don't add to their skills or their learning at all, to people who go to college. Well, that's like saying that's like college is like a standardized way to deliver education. And it does deliver education, but it's sort of like that cafeteria. You know, there's so many other options out there. There's super fine, you know, French restaurants, and there's going to the farmer's market and getting a picnic out of, you know, freshly picked vegetables. And there's, you know, there's hunting for the food. There's gardening it yourself. There's 100 different ways to get that food. And so to your question, I mean, you say, like, you got your education in the dorm room. Absolutely. You know, and there are ways you can we can recreate that if you want.
That's really what I think is needed.
Yeah.
That's really what I think is needed. So many people need that dorm room, whether it's a virtual dorm room or a real one. But that kind of environment within which education is valued, but you're not being put through a mold, if you see my point.
Yes.
And I think unschooling could provide that. We could have centers in which one can have a certain amount of leadership. If you look at, for example, the way tutelage takes place in Oxford and Cambridge, there are very few dropouts there because there's hand-holding all the way through. They have tutors outside of their classroom just helping people at every step of the way. Isn't it possible to have an environment like that that will help people, if they want to, take traditional online classes or classes of a different sort, or simply avail oneself of the tremendous amount of information that comes free over the Internet, very often from accredited institutions, and use that to get an education, whether accredited or not?
Yes. Absolutely. I'm totally with you. I mean, there's so many informal ways. Dale, you're kind of the pro of this because this is the stuff you're thinking about all day. Do you have any thoughts on that one?
It's been really interesting to see startups and projects and enterprises that have popped up around this idea of creating community. A couple of years ago, a company called Teach Street launched, which allows people to create courses in their own homes. A newer version of that, a competitor, is also available in New York called Skillshare. There's a company called TechShop, which has a couple locations in the Bay Area where people are able to go and use labs with lab equipment, everything from Bunsen burners to TIG welders to create actual and build things. And they're planning to expand across the country. So it's really exciting to see examples of this community being created outside of traditional institutions. Another thing that's very common in the Bay Area is for people to launch startups working out of their own home and have quote-unquote hack houses where people live together and hack on projects, which recreates that dorm room experience.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So thank you so much. That was a great question. *2, anyone who's on the line, we've got the system working now. *2 if you want to raise your hand. In the meantime, here's a really good question on the question board, which you can access on that page where you access the webcast. Here's a good one. Do either of you still pursue learning just for the sake of learning, even now that you have launched your careers? And how are you doing this on a daily basis? Fantastic question. I would say if there's one blind spot I have in my book, or one thing that I might do differently if I were to rewrite it over, it would be to emphasize this point more, is that I focus really on practical skills in the book, and I think someone could fairly come away with that thinking that I'm kind of a Philistine who just cares about like practical things and not more philosophical or aesthetic or existential things. And in fact, the opposite is true. I mean, at my heart, I'm a writer. I read, you know, all kinds of literature, philosophy, psychology, spirituality, religion. If you look at my bookshelf, it's full of all the great thinkers and the great fields of study, popular science. I'm not a scientist myself, but I read quite a bit of serious popularization of science for a general audience. And so I have a very curious mind, and I know Dale does also, and that is key. And I probably don't emphasize that enough in my book, but I'll emphasize it now, is that curiosity, that passion for learning. There's that quote, I think it was Yeats, it gets attributed to Yeats a lot, that it's something along the lines of, like, education is not a pail to be filled, but a fire to be lit. And so I really agree with that. Whoever said that, is that it's not about stuffing ourselves full of facts. Like, all you have to do is light that fire. And if you think about it, because of our test-taking system that we have constructed for ourselves, we do the opposite of that. So we, you know, anything that's not on the test is frowned upon. Anything that can't be spit back in a test answer or written in some essay for a test, you're not going to learn. So we naturally kill kids' curiosity. And there's a great book out there called Readicide. Like, instead of genocide, readicide. And it's basically about how our education system from a young age right through college actually kills the passion for reading. Like, I think if you reflect on your own educational system, your own education, you'll find this to be true. Like, when I was 15, I was very, very passionate about radical environmentalism. Don't ask me how I got into that. It's a long story. But I was, like, obsessed with, like, really, really hardcore environmental theory. And I was, like, reading all these books by very serious thinkers on the topic. And I could discuss with the best of them the finer points of environmentalism and environmental philosophy and activism and all these debates that were happening and are happening around the environment. Now, not only did I not get any encouragement for that in my formal education, but I was discouraged because it was like, well, that's not on the curriculum. You got to read this book that we're having a test on next week. So I'd have to read. Here I was, 15, passionately desiring to read about these things, and I'm being told, no, you got to read this shit you don't even care about, and then pretend to be interested in it enough to regurgitate some facts about it on the test. Well, that, again, is an insane system. We're training this natural curiosity out of ourselves. If you have emerged from your schooling with any curiosity about reading, it's usually in spite of your formal education, not because of it. And this has to be changed. And for us to be successful, we have to nurture that curiosity in ourselves. Dale, what are your thoughts on that?
I think the biggest difference that I come down with among people is a disagreement on whether people are naturally curious. And that may sound really stupid, but we've got an education system that tells students that there's one answer at the back of the book, and it's not even correct half the time. And when you're raised in that system, it's really hard to step out of it. The biggest gift that my parents ever gave me was believing in me enough to allow me to make my own decisions. And I think one of the biggest changes that needs to be made is at the level of parenting, and getting parents to believe in their children and give their children the freedom and autonomy to make their own decisions, whether that's about education or whether that's about their clothing choices or where they want to go on vacation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm not a parent, so I can't speak with any authority about what parents should or should not do. I have no idea personally what it is like to be a parent. So, you know, I take what I'm about to say out there with a grain of salt. I do think that there is a danger that parents get into, which is that assuming that the rules that applied when they were making their way in the world still apply. So here's a perfect example. You know, parents out there, they really want their kids to go to college, and they push their kids to go to college for the most part. Dale, your parents were an exception. My parents didn't really push me, but they didn't have to. It was, like, so assumed that I would go to college that it wasn't even a discussion. But parents, when they push their kids like that, they are thinking about the rules that applied when they were making their way. So let's take your typical, you know, baby boomer parents that they were coming into young adulthood in the 60s. You know, that was a time when formal education made a lot of sense. It was inexpensive. It was mostly you know, state, like very, very well subsidized by the state, which of course has totally changed now. It was cheap, you know, maybe $200 a semester. Even given inflation, that was still cheap. And you were in an environment where we didn't have that many people with BAs out there. So there was, you know, in the 50s and the 60s and even the 70s, there weren't that many people with higher education. Most people had college, high school diplomas. So if you had higher education, you had a real advantage. So you had a huge advantage with higher education, and it was cheap as hell. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Go to college. But we're in a totally different universe now that the kids are getting are aware of, but the parents haven't really adjusted their thinking. And we have the opposite of those two things. We have college incredibly expensive. You know, a private college, that Sarah Lawrence is the most expensive college in the world, in the country. It's $50,000 a year. I mean, think about that, $50,000. 4 years of that is somewhere around the median price of a home in America. So, the price of a home for education, and a lot of that is going to come on debt. The kids are going to have to take out loans. The loans are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So if they, it becomes this high risk situation where if they don't get that job out of college, they're screwed because now they have loan payments to make on a loan that can't be discharged in bankruptcy, and they could go into default. So you know, it's a totally different universe, and the job prospects of BAs have gone down. Now, it's not like if you have a BA, everyone's clamoring to hire you because you have a BA. It's the opposite. It's like join the club. And I just read an article in the New York Times. The title was, you can look this up, the title was, the Masters is the New Bachelors. The Masters as the New Bachelors was the title. And it was basically saying, well, now that everyone has a BA, all these people are going to get Masters to stand out from the pack, just the way people in the 60s and 70s got BAs to stand out from the pack of the high school diplomas. So the situation has totally changed, but the parents haven't caught on and are still giving their kids advice that was relevant to the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but is no longer relevant today. So we are now at the almost 100-minute mark, and we're gonna wrap up. Thank you all so much for being on the line. Thank you, Dale, so much for taking the time and for giving me the chance to speak to your audience.
Michael, thank you for telling us a little bit about your book, and I hope that everyone listening in was able to get a better understanding of what The Education of Millionaires is about. It's available for pre-order on Amazon.com, and will be out on Wednesday. Is that correct?
Yeah, on Thursday. So
Thursday.
I have it in my hands. It's I'm really proud of it. And just if people are curious, let me just for 1 minute just explain kind of why I wrote this book. Is, you know, basically if any of what we've been talking about in the last 90 minutes or so is resonating with you out there, my book starts at the point we've just finished at in this call and gives you the specific action plans to implement this kind of mindset in a way that will actually be successful in your life. It gives very specific, almost lesson plans or curricula, if you will, based on these self-educated people of the universal success skills that you need to learn in any market, no matter what career you're going to take. You've got to learn these skills, and the book shows you the way forward. So I think I'm biased, of course, but it's $17. I think it's a great investment if you're interested in the stuff we've been talking about, and you can get it on Amazon. So thank you, everyone out there, so much for your time, and look forward to continuing the dialogue. Thank you so much, Dale.
Thank you, Michael.
Bye.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.